people I don't, the two people I don't know, Rui and Clara, is English okay? All right. And since you don't know me, so my name is Joa. I'm Roshi's Dharma successor. There are two threads of thoughts that are coming up just before sitting. I was remembering Roshi's talk from last week about the 20th anniversary of her transmission, or Wildflower, even though it's, Wildflower was created a little bit after. And the emotion or word that came up, or the image that came up, was what a companionship it has been. Not just with Roshi, but with everyone. It's really funny these days. I've tried to sit every morning. Usually on Tuesday it was a little bit difficult for me, Tuesday morning, but I kind of managed to come, and so I would see some of the people, including Debbie, online in the morning, and then sometimes in the evening, and then during the day I have the luxury, the privilege to be able to sit with groups in institutions, and then I come in the evening, and then yesterday there was a sitting group at my place. So it's just ongoing. And I say that all the time, but I really mean it. The how much the Sangha is the community, the people we practice with, is such a support for my practice. And vice versa. And I notice also the difference. So today is the 20 September 26. So we've started again, well, I've started again, because the morning practice continued during the summer, but I wasn't part of it. So I started again the morning practice for less than a month. And for a month, I was traveling around, moving a lot, and just didn't sit. And I can really feel the difference in the quality of my life, my how grounded I am. It does make a huge difference. And I'm so glad to have found again that by just simply sitting, finding again that stability that deeper sense of clarity, of calm. And So that's kind of also that leads to the second thread, and this is something I for the past days that I've stayed with. I had a voice message from someone I know, and she said, "Oh, I kind of had a really nice summer, but now since I started working again, just everything is collapsing. I just feel I started to take pills against anxiety. I just feel I'm totally on the verge of burnout." And she's a lawyer working a lot with on harassment cases and sexual abuse, and she said, "I'm just overwhelmed by the work I'm doing." And the kind of the first word that popped up in my head was self-care. How difficult it is often to care for oneself. How difficult it is to find inner peace and find the space and find also the practice that suits us. And of course, my immediate answer for me is meditation. Meditation, sitting on a cushion, creates that sense of space, allowing ourselves to just calm down. And it happens very often in the institution where I lead meditation sessions, that and especially one where it's a so at INSEAD, where there are students, MBA students, and students in master who do masters in management, that they are the drive that brings them to sitting is just finding a place where they can come back home, as we would say in our jargon, and take care of themselves. And because I have all these, I do a lot of sessions with people who have barely any background in meditation. I end up explaining a lot, what is happening, what can we do, and all that. And it It becomes clearer and clearer to me that it's as if there were various phases or various practices or various aspects. And I feel I've talked a lot about that already, but the when we all sit on a retreat or just even on screen, I always, sometimes, very often, do I wonder, how is their practice? What do they actually do on their side? What's the experience? And how do they, what kind of technique or tools or do they use? I often wonder. And by asking that, also I ask that because I know from my own practice that there are periods when I would practice one particular in a one particular way, another time where I would practice another particular way, Is it all the same, or does it target different things? Can one be done before doing the other one? So I keep exploring this. And maybe one way to, in my experience, one way to map what is being done is, and this is basically what we do with when we do introductions to meditation, is just offering a technique that allows just people to just, I like that term, to land here and just to, yeah, go back home, just quiet down and come back, and just could be just following the breath or doing a body scan or anything that connects us with the body, simply just letting things down, letting things kind of cool down. 10K Roshi call that harmonizing body and mind. That sense of really paying attention to the body and paying attention to what is going on in our mind. And when I have these students that practice that, sometimes it's just enough. And sometimes maybe that's the starting point when the mind is so confused. If those of you who work on koan, sometimes it's just very just difficult to work on the koan because we haven't achieved that quietness of the body and the mind, that harmonizing the body and the mind. And sometimes it's just so difficult to just so difficult to achieve. And even if we have practiced for years, if we are in a situation where it's a little bit hectic, it's just very difficult to achieve that harmonizing. Harmonization of the body and mind. And when that happens, when we feel we are connected and feels good, it feels, and we are able to just stay there and appreciate and remain in that state. I love the expression of the koan, like dwelling in nowhere. When we are able to dwell in nowhere, when we're able to just yeah, another expression that speaks to me is just when we're able to see the arising of things and the ceasing of things, or feeling like we are on the bank of a river and we're just looking at the river that is flowing. We're able to just remain there, just watching without being embarked with the flow of thoughts, with the sensation of discomfort or comfort. We're just able to remain there. So that's a second phase, a second dimension of it. And one could say that could be associated with the practice of shikantaza, just an open awareness, which is seeing. So that's another practice, or another practice that corresponds to another experience, let's say. And that allows us, and I do find that it's quite different. That allows us sometimes to see the arising of subjects. Sometimes when I do these workshops, one of the instructions I give in the guided meditation at some point is, do you notice anything that kept coming back, like a thought that kept coming back? And if we were dwelling in nowhere and there's a thought that keeps coming back, I feel, well, this is an object that I could actually, take. Maybe there's something for me to look into. And that we take that object, and that object can be like a koan also. But an object of thought could be an object of what arises could be, God, why do I put myself, why do I feel so much anger each time in this situation or this interaction with that person? What happened? And we take it as a koan, we take it as a lively question in order to apply that practice of samadhi, of just really contemplation, openness, and see what is arising. So again, I feel this is very different from the first and the two mode. And if I was thinking, how can we map that? Would that make any sense to map that with the four vows that we keep re that we recite every day when we meet online and during retreats? The four vows. I do feel that we can look at the vows as various modes of meditation. And I'm always very kind of puzzled by the order of the vows, of the four vows. So there's the one about delusion, there's the one about reality, there is the one about the way of the Buddha, and there is the one about sentient beings. Well, in the order, sentient beings, delusions are inexhaustible, reality is boundless, and the Buddha way is inexhaustible. It feels that reality is boundless. The one about reality is boundless is really going into this dwelling in nowhere. In the sense that when we chant that vow, we really, the action that is associated with it is really just open up and see what Bernie would call the ingredients of our lives, or the ingredients of what is arising right here, right now. Reality is boundless, and can I just see all of that through my senses, the mind, the thoughts that keeps arising, that keeps coming up and keeps leaving me. Delusion is inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. It feels like here we are applying this clear observation. This, when we look at an object, it's like we're really kind of looking into something. And we can really, I was about to say grasp, but not grasp, but take an object as an object of meditation, really kind of investigate. For me, there's this dimension of investigation that can be very fruitful in our meditation, kind of this mode of meditation when we really investigate a particular object of mind, a particular thought, a particular sensation, a particular feeling and see what is it? What am I clinging to? What's the nature of it? And we really just go deep into it. The fourth one, the Buddha way, is inexhaustible. I vow to embody it. It's the Buddha way is the Eightfold Path. So it's this ethical path. And I feel in a way it implies, it includes meditation, the practice of meditation as a formal practice, as in Zazen, but it also applies, what do we do when we stand up from our cushion and we leave the Zendo or we leave our room and we go out and we interact with people? So that's really kind of meditation in action, in a way. And to me, that's the exciting part. I really, really, really love sitting, but I would hate to so that my life would be just reduced to sitting and sleeping. There's so many interesting things to do. And to live my life is, yeah, to work, to engage with people, to, all the realms of the existence, all the things that we do, and play music and just, do all kinds of things. But can I do that from a space of non-reactivity, a sense of care, etc., following the Eightfold Path? And so the first one, I think it was yesterday, I was reflecting about that. I was talking to someone how, oh yeah, I was working on a koan with someone, and I was saying, so investigate what's your fundamental, what brought you to the practice? What's the drive? What was the drive? And for many people, including myself, the initial impulse was not saving all sentient beings. Was my own personal suffering. And I was, it seems almost like when we're looking at the, not sure, but it seems that when we're looking at the story of the Buddha, it's always told in a way that it does feel like it's more about the suffering in general of people. So I'm intrigued that when we sing that, it's the first vow out of the four vows. Yet it's a very, it's very advanced in a way. If I look at my own process, saving all sentient beings, that wasn't my initial intention. And if we look at the various modes of meditation, that dimension of the other, is really in the realm of the Eightfold Path. And yet connecting to saying that first line, the very, very beginning for me, it's always like, it really puts me in a very kind of wide space. I'm not doing it for myself. Or that also brings me back to my name as celui qui sauve, the one who saves. What does it mean to save all sentient beings? Seems very problematic, very curious. What is there to save? Who is there to save? Who is saving? Who is saving who? It seems to me that the more logical way would be reality is boundless. Delusions are inexhaustible. I see the reality. I really vow to look at objects and see the delusions of it. I walk the path of the Buddha. And as I walk the path of the Buddha, I'm in the realm of the interpersonal interbeings, and through I'm not even sure how to finish that sentence for the and I'm doing my best in the midst of our crazy world. I'm doing my best to alleviate suffering. I do my best to contribute to act for the so that it's beneficial for myself and for others. Something like that. I read that quote 2 weeks ago, I think, or last, yeah, 2 weeks ago when Debbie was there, that on Wednesday night, and it keeps maturing in me. I really like it. It's from Damien Keehan, and he wrote, I forgot how to pronounce it, sow an act, so ensemencer, semer, planter, sow an act, reap a habit, sow a habit, reap a character, sow a character, reap a destiny. I really like it. I can really see how just, if we sit, if I start sitting for a while and just it really becomes a habit, then it shapes something in me. And by shaping oneself, life starts, the existence starts to take a different route than it would have otherwise. So this is why I always love going back to the question, what do I want? What's my fundamental intention? Because otherwise it's very hard to know what act to do, what seed to plant. It's like we could plant an infinite diversity of seed, but what is the seed that we want to plant? And I feel the four vows or the Eightfold Path encapsulates all the vows that we take when we take refuge, when we take Dukkha, when we receive Dukkha. It's can we really connect to that and thinking, this is really what I want for myself? Yeah, I find it very inspiring to not just sing the vows, but really connect to the vows and think, what does that mean to me? And is this what I want for myself, for my life? Bye, Miguel. So your message. Yeah, maybe I'll stop here and open the floor for comments and feedbacks and questions and whatever. Yeah, Krisha.
Hi everyone, good evening. I was trying. Let me talk really soon before I forgot, but I'm forgetting. Because this is linked with a kind of, do you know when you feel like you are enlightened, you have an enlightenment or an epiphany or whatever, but then you lose it. And then you know that you have it, that was something about it. You now it's just conceptual, but you know you felt it a bit. And I was linking, and now the linking also disappeared. But it's well, my enlightenment, it's really simple, but it was about love and love clinging, probably. And love the practice, and realized in a moment, in a glimpse of a moment, oh yeah, but I am love, or I am loved. There's nothing to, I am loved, and I am love. Everything it's okay. There's nothing to cling or to seek. Everything it's there. But I have it as a glimpse of something. Now this is merely conceptual. I'm not it's not here anymore. And you talking about the practice and the saving part, which is very controversial. And I was really feeling how controversial it can be. I never thought in the practice, me myself personally, and I of course I'm not in your shoes about saving anyone, and I still don't. For me it will be something really awkward. I would feel embarrassed only just to think or to put myself in that. It would be a no-go in a simply way. And I never know how to answer what was my drive to the practice, because this was at early 16. And I think it's just because I loved, I really admired. I had a stepfather who was really Christian and he meditated all mornings. But Christian, it's not for me because I don't believe in God. And I really tried, but I don't. And he presented me Zen. The practice of the discipline of waking up, meditating, for me, it's something I admire. But I never thought it could be so interior, such a path, such a revealing path. I never thought of it. Much, much later, I got that. And now this is where I lose it. Because I think the saving is linked with the love. Or in a more conceptual way, of course, the practice, giving the practice, it's a way for giving means to others to wake up in awareness, loving the boundless bounding. But it's your root. You're not saving anyone in a more traditional feeling about the word itself. But yeah, this is what I wanted to share. It's not very well linked, but well, it's a glimpse. And thank you. Thank you, Joa, for your saying.
Yeah, I have a problem with the word saving. I'm much more comfortable with the word serving than saving. Just to vow to serve people, just to be at the service of than saving. And yeah, I. Not only is it loaded from our Christian heritage, that word is very loaded, but also it feels, it's as if almost it's a trap. It's a trap in the sense of, are you going to fall into it? It feels a little bit like a trap. As are you going to fall into the trap of, you are going to save someone. So in that sense, it's a very good koan. I think, I mean, we had countless discussions, it feels, with Roshi about that line and whether or not we should change it and why are we not changing it and all that. So but I think it has the virtue of of asking the question and let us react. As I said, this is my name on top of it, but the funny thing is when I asked Maizumi's brother about how he would translate into Japanese my name, he came up with Fugen, and Fugen is just the name of the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra. And so, which is the person who's the bodhisattva that is at the service of others, right? So, yeah, we should not be too wrapped up with translations also, and I link it kind of also to the discussion I had with Roshi and also with other teachers about, and recently when I was at Zen River with Tenke Roshi, who said, oh, I don't feel I'm teaching, I'm sharing. And what are we teaching? What am I teaching? Are we in? Can we even say we're teachers? We're Zen teachers. Teachers. What are we teaching? What does it mean to teach? It's not like, so everything becomes. I feel it's a lot of traps. There are a lot of traps out there. Clara? Yeah.
I was just going to share with you that in Spanish, the way we recite this, it's probably been changed somewhere along the way, and we don't say the word save. We say to the benefit of all beings, to benefit or something like this, it would be. Just to share that.
Can I try to see quickly if I have somewhere, because at some point, oh yeah, just the versions of Thich Nhat Hanh of the vows, and funnily enough, yeah, the order is changed. The awakened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it, so that would be our fourth vow. However innumerable beings are, I vow to meet them with kindness and interest. However inexhaustible the states of suffering are, I vow to touch them with patience and love. However immeasurable the dharmas are, I vow to explore them deeply. However incomparable the mystery of interbeing, I vow to surrender to it freely. So the saving, yeah. I vow to meet them with kindness and interest. So that's less loaded, maybe.
I think that at Zen Heart Sangha, where we were this summer, I think they said freedom. It was in Dutch, so hard to know, but I think it was freeing. And it had surprised me, actually. I mean, it was, anyway, another.
Yet there is still this idea that we're doing something.
That's quite big, too.
I always remember the thing of, I forgot who it was, this thing with when we see that someone is, that we need to save them, that means we're seeing them as they're broken, there's something to repair. Right? That's the, I forgot who was the Roshi, you remember who was the person who,
Yep, Rachel Raman, Rachel Noemi Raman, or something like that.
right, okay. Not sure. I have it somewhere. But I like this idea of how do we, do we feel that we feel that there is something to be fixed or not? Is there something that we need to fix in us or not? Or in others? Or do we see that it's complete? And it kind of changes the perspective on the saving or serving. Yeah, Debbie?
Joe, who gave you your Dharma name?
Geno. Geno Roshi. And I remember very clearly when she gave it to me, and she said to me, "You know it, right?" And I answered, "Yes." And I keep coming back to that interaction. I was like, "What did it mean?" My answer and her question. And maybe what comes up for me is, the underlying intention of, it's not about just me. It's the practice is about something to be shared. I guess this is probably a vague intuition that I had. and a strong commitment that I hold now.
My other question, I think I already asked you, but since Roshi is here, maybe she knows. When we do the third round of the vows, I often wondered why we hit the 1, 3, and 4, but not 2. Is there a reason? Well, there's a reason, but I mean, is there a reason anybody knows? You know what I mean? Ding. Sentient beings are numberless, and we don't do illusions are I was gonna say unforgettable. Illusions are whatever they are there.
Yeah, I remember you asked me the
Yeah, I
question. I don't
asked
know
you.
the answer. I don't know if you're Roshi, you know the answer, but I don't.
Well, I think that we ring for we ring after we've finished the second round, so after we've said the fourth vow the second time, we ring to signal that we're starting the final round.
Okay.
I think this is what I think it is. And then we don't ring after the first one because we've already announced that this is the last round. And then I guess we ring after the next one to signal that we're coming towards the end, and then we ring after the third one to say this is the last one. I think. I'm sure there's some, intricate ritual explanation. I don't know.
I just wondered if 1, 3, and 4 had something to do with each other that 2 didn't have to do with the rest of them or something like that.
No, we don't ring after one. We ring after the final vow after the second round. It's before
Oh, I
one.
see what you're saying. Yeah, it's the end of the other one and not the beginning of the next one. Okay. That already explains
And
it.
maybe Clara, who comes from a more formal situation, maybe she knows. I don't know.
We usually don't recite this verse in particular so often, so I'm not really with the practice very fresh in my.
Okay. There's one thing though that I've noticed is that it's very logical the way we ring. So we start with three, then we two, and then back to three and two and back to three. And when we finish without singing the vows, it's one. 3, 2, 1 always. And the last bells are three. We never ring four. So I don't know. That's my take on it. And so we finish with three. We start with three and we finish with three.
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, so if we stay in this, it's true that we do always, it's always in groups of three, the bells. So say we would, when we start the vows, we go
Ding, dirt,
ding,
ding.
dun, ding, so that's two. And then we do, before we start the final round, we ring one.
Yeah, okay.
And then we ring three after each of
Okay.
them.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, already that makes me see it differently. And the
But
other thing I'm sorry.
go ahead.
Oh.
Yeah, go ahead.
No. Just to share, I always thought it was remeter for the refugee. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The three sounds. Don't know if I like to think about it, but and it's a common way that I myself in inner meditation finalize it. Just to share, but as absolutely no professional theory. Underground, background.
And the other thing that came to my mind about this saving business, funny because as you were talking about it, I feel very differently about it now because it really put me off in the beginning. I mean, you've got Jesus on the cross, the minute you start talking about save and savior and the whole thing is, and I'm not anti-Christian, but it was just a little bit hard to take. Is maybe it's a little bit like there aren't any enlightened people, there are only enlightened moments. There are times when people have saved me. At that moment, they have, yeah, I mean, there are other ways to say it, but I was drowning and they reached out their hand, sort of thing. And I feel that there are moments when I've done that for other people. It's a moment. I mean, that we didn't all join together and change the world afterwards. But, you know, it's, there are times when you're at the right place in somebody's life, or they're there for you in your life, that really feels like a saving moment. So, and that's the way I was feeling about it when you were using the word this time. But I suppose it all depends, because it's true that if you dive back into the Christian roots of it, it's a, I mean, you're what now? You're the person who saves the world. That's too bad.
Yeah, what you're saying, David, just puts me into an abyss of perplexity, because it. It's like I also can recall moments where I feel, I often say, you know, my psychoanalysis saved my life. And he saved my life by allowing that space for me to explore. But I think if he was like, if he had been too kind of pushy and with an intention of me as a psychoanalyst, I'm going to save your life, or I could say the same thing with Roshi, just that wouldn't have worked probably. And so there's something to really let go of about the clinging of saving in order to save, something like that, or in order to bring some, yeah, comfort or peace of mind or be useful in some form or another. And this is where the same thing is operates with a teaching. If I feel like I am teaching and I am bringing some stuff to them, it can't be forced, and that's not going to work. So, and that's too much. It's not that it's not going to work, but this is too much loaded. It's too much anchored in me, in the me. I don't know if it's clear, but there's something to let go of. And I feel that this is also what is being practiced and what is the vehicle of the Dharma talk. The way we've been practicing it in our lineage, which is forget about the notes, forget about the if we prepare too much, then the me gets on the way more easily. Yeah, Christian.
About the world, the word itself, with no, of course, it's a tough word, but the salvation part for me, it's no big problem. I can totally see it in this sense. I always remember if the way of the Buddha, it's an invitation. What he's proposing, I think it, and this is very important. It's very important for me and for us and for, well, whatever, for me at least, because it's an invitation. He's not inviting to follow him. He's inviting to experiment, for experience what he's saying, not to believe in him. The salvation, you are the salvation. He studied, had all that experience, and now he wants to share it. It's in our benefit. I really liked the Spanish word, or a freeing, but if we think, or I don't know, salvation of humankind. Today, the Pope in Portugal, on the radio, he was talking about us, European. He was remembering that we don't have such our collective memory is not so good in the sense. He referred Second World War and he referred open hostilities and the price for humankind, the death, the really impact, and why not salvation? Not in a Catholic or Christian way, but yeah, we live all together. In a place, in a world, we are a community, and a lot of times we are not together. We are fighting with each other in a really hostile way, with really big impacts. And our vows, the Buddha way, it's all about that. All about don't experiment yourself. You'll see. So I think it's okay. It's not about me. It's not about me saving no one. I think it's a really important premise, and I think it's one of it's really important for me because I don't go to other because of that. In this way, it's really trustful. You can really engage yourself to see it. And maybe grow and maybe save in the benefit. Don't know, just to share that.
Thank you. All right, it's time. We'll end here. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And,